Pass the bills.
We will call to order the House Committee on Land Use and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 691A. I have on the list Stephen Cafori and Ray Wilkinson, please.
Didn't have a chance today.
I didn't know, so I kept
Thank
it
you.
Here
Thank
until
you.
I'm ready.
What happened to Wilkinson?
You had a little
I don't care if you want to, come together.
B6. Which one?
Whoever's first. Are they opposed to each other?
I don't know.
690.
You don't have to appear together if you don't want.
Oh, I'm only standing next to Ray.
September. That's
the only two who signed up.
How do you really feel?
Yeah, it's just me. We're going to get Mark in size.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Wilkinson. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council and here today in support of Senate Bill 691A. This bill makes several relatively modest changes to ballot measure 49, which is, I'm sure you all know, was passed by the voters in 2007. The history of this bill, I'm sure you have in your packet, but it's already been approved by the Senate on a 29-1 vote. In addition to OFIC, testimony in support of the bill in the Senate included the Thousand Friends of Oregon and the Defenders of Wildlife. Also during the work session on the bill in the Senate committee, Richard Whitman, the director of DLCD, who's here to speak for himself, and if I miss quoting, I'm sure he will, but he went through the amendments to the bill at that time and indicated that if those amendments were adopted, which they were, that the governor would support the bill. So most people believe or think of Measure 49 in terms of the development side of it and kind of adjudicating the Measure 37 claims and that sort of thing, but there's another part of Measure 49, as I'm sure the Land Use Committee knows, which allows landowners to apply for compensation or waivers of future regulations if those regulations impact the value of their property. That's the part of Measure 49 that this bill amends, and it amends it only as it applies to forest practices regulations adopted in the future, most likely by the Board of Forestry or through amendments to the Forest Practices Act adopted by the legislature. The reason why this bill is before you is because the process laid out in Measure 49 to allow landowners to file those types of claims in the future doesn't work very well for forest practices regulations. And the reason for that is there's a very long period, a holding period, for growing trees, obviously. And for instance, if a regulation was adopted in the future or a law was passed in the future that increased the requirements on private forest land to leave trees along streams. Right now, for example, there's a buffer of trees that we're required to leave. It's 100 feet wide. Well, in the future, a regulation could be adopted that says that should be 300 feet wide. Well, we would like the opportunity to file a claim for that cost of that regulation if that ever happened. We hope it wouldn't. That wouldn't make much sense from our perspective. But if somebody owned trees that are just newly planted, 5 years old, 10 years old, the impact of that regulation wouldn't really be felt for 40 or 50 years until they're ready to be harvested. So for that, that's an example of why the mechanism in Measure 49 to process Measure 49 claims for future regulations doesn't work very well for forestry. So we brought this bill forward. It was introduced at our request by Senator Johnson. It does make several minor tweaks, and I'll just briefly tick them off. It's in my testimony. There's basically five things that it would do, and I can point out where the language is in the bill specifically if you would like. The first one expands the types of forest practices claims that could be made for future, that adopted in the future to rules that go beyond the Forest Practices Act if that ever happened. We're mainly looking at potential ballot measures there. If there was a ballot measure, for instance, to ban clear cutting that was approved, which we hope that would never happen, but if it did and the measure said this is not an amendment to the Forest Practices Act, then we wouldn't be able to seek any relief for the costs of that. So this would expand the scope in that fashion. Number two, forest practices claims would be allowed even if the highest and best use of the property is something else. For some reason, I've never understood why, but I'm sure there's a good reason. Measure 49 says you can only file a future claim if the regulation that you're concerned about regulates the highest and best use of the land. If it doesn't, you can't file a claim. So, in other words, if even if you weren't allowed to build or develop, if you own forest land close to an urban area and the highest and best use was development or it was worth more for development than it was for forestry, you wouldn't be able to file a claim for a forest practices regulation, which doesn't make sense. I'm sure that makes sense for other reasons, but it doesn't for that. So it would carve that out. The third point, Measure 49 has a pretty elaborate process for establishing the loss of fair market value if you're going to make a claim in the future, and you have to compare the value of the property a year before the regulation was enacted to a year after it was enacted, and you have to have a certified or licensed appraiser that follows certain appraisal standards. That doesn't work very well for forest practices regulations either, so Senate Bill 691 would allow for forest practices an appraisal conducted in accordance with generally accepted forest industry practices to be, and that would basically involve a licensed or consulting forester make an assessment about how a regulation affects the fair market value of the land based on the growth potential of trees and that sort of thing. The fourth tweak that this bill accomplishes is it allows waivers that are obtained if compensation is not forthcoming by a landowner to be transferred to a subsequent owner. So if that person with 10-year-old trees secured a waiver and then had to sell the land 10 years later, the price would not be discounted due to the fact that the new owner would be subject to that regulation. The new owner could get the waiver and therefore would be willing to pay the full market value of the property. And finally, there was an issue about, on a forest practices claim, what part of the property should the claim be applied to. We argued that it should be applied only to the portion of the property that is affected by the regulation, for instance, the stream buffer itself, as opposed to the entire parcel, which for large landowners could be a very large contiguous area. A good example, Weyerhaeuser's Molalla Tree Farm is 60,000 acres all in one block. So we didn't want to have to file file a Measure 49 claim for 60,000 acres, the effect on the value of a 60,000 acre block due to a regulation that affected only a very small and discrete portion of that property. There was a pushback to that in the negotiations we did in the Senate, and understandable. So we compromised on that with the other interested parties, and now your claim is filed on what's called a lawfully established unit of land, which is a term of art in Chapter 62 of Oregon law that I don't fully understand, but as it was explained to me, it's the smallest parcel that could legally be sold separately, so it's not kind of like a minimum lot, so an 80 acres or a 160 or something like that. So anyway, those are the tweaks that this bill makes to Measure 49. We would submit that this is a modest bill. Mr. Kefauri, I looked on the chart that he signed up in opposition, but there was no opposition testimony to this at all in the Senate. We hope and expect, actually, that this law, if it's adopted, would never be used, that we would never have to use this, that the regulation of forestry in Oregon would never get to the point where landowners felt it was necessary to seek compensation because the provisions are so egregious. And I think we accept the reasonable regulation as a cost of doing business. During the three-year period that Measure 37 was on the books, forest landowners in Oregon could have filed claims based on to get compensation or waivers of the existing forest practices regulations. There was not a single claim filed by any member of OFIC, which is 90% of the industrial forest land in Oregon, even though they could have under Measure 37. So I think that shows that we're sincere when we say we're not interested in just getting paid for doing what we should be doing to protect public resources on our land. What we worry about is a day in the future that we hope never comes where those regulations get to be excessive and get to be adopted based on politics rather than science. And we have reason to be concerned about that because that exact thing has happened in Washington and California where those regulations have been, that process has been politicized, and the regulations up there have gotten to be unreasonable and excessive. And what happens is that forces landowners to consider other uses of their land and leads to conversion of forest land to development and other uses, which is not in anybody's interest, I don't think. So that's what we're trying to avoid. We were very grateful, Mr. Chair, that Thousand Friends of Oregon in particular worked closely with us on the Senate on this and came to a version of the bill that they could support, and I think they share our motivation. And attached to my testimony is an editorial that appeared in the Oregonian a few months ago that's kind of consistent with the theme of this bill and the need to keep forest land and forest use is working for us, and gives credit to moderate environmental groups for recognizing that. And I think this bill is a good example of that. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and appreciate your attention to it.
Okay, are there questions for Mr. Wilkerson? Okay, Mr. Kafouri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafouri. I'm representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. The Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association has over 950 members, including both public and private professional land use planners, land use lawyers, citizens, planning commissioners, and other public officials. We have proposed to Senate Bill 691 for the following reasons. In 2007, Oregonians addressed, before I begin, Mr. Chair, let me just say that this testimony was going to be presented by a member of our association who was the last minute could not get here, and so I am reading that testimony. I generally speaking don't like to read testimony, but the testifier is not available and I'm substituting. The Oregonians addressed the issues of claims for compensation based on land use regulations that restrict the use of private property by approving Ballot Measure 49. Ballot Measure 49 was approved as a fix to 37 by providing a better balance of fairness to both claimants and surrounding property owners, as well as protection of prime forest and farmland. 691, however, carves out special remedies in consideration for forest land that Oregonians did not see fit to approve in 2007. The bill broadens the scope of compensation in four ways. One, expanding the types of regulation that can give a rise to a claim for compensation for forest land. Two, creating an expanded method of determining loss of value for forest land. Three, allowing multiple claims for the same property. Claims for the same property based on different regulations may be brought at different times. In contrast, only one claim for each property is allowed on non-forest land, according to Ballot Measure 49. And also allowing transferability of relief. Again, an issue that was specifically not allowed in Ballot Measure 49. We oppose the passage of this bill. We think it would weaken the protection of forest land and carve out special remedies for one class of property owners. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions for the panel? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Is anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 691? Mr. Whitman?
Thank you, Chair Garrett. Members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman, the director of the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm really here today, though not in that capacity, but more in a technical capacity, having helped facilitate this discussion with the governor's office, the Oregon Department of Forestry, OFIC, on this issue. And I've got with me today
Peter Doherty. I'm the deputy chief of the Private Forest Division, which is a division that administers the Forest Practice Act. And again, I'm here on a technical basis, but have been following this bill as it's developed.
So, Chair Garrett, we're here to answer any questions that the committee might have. I am able to say on behalf of the governor's office, though, that the governor's office is generally supportive of this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Because you're off the hook. Thank you. This bill is scheduled for hearing only, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 691 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 763A. Is this it? Nan Evans?
And may I bring...
Yeah. Yes.
PDR.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Nan Evans. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Nature Conservancy in Oregon. Here to speak to you briefly about Senate Bill 763A. We're very supportive at the Conservancy for the concept of transferable development credits as adding a possible additional tool to our land use system. And this was one of the things, by the way, during the Big Look that we talked a great deal to the task force about, was expanding the range of essentially market tools. We are also particularly excited about the fact that the legislature, the Senate, has seen the applicability of ODFNW, and hence my, I asked Ron England of the Department of Fish and Wildlife to join me here. We're particularly excited about seeing how to employ the Oregon Conservation Strategy that was developed by the Fish and Wildlife Department in these kinds of incentive-based tools. In case you don't know about the Oregon Conservation Strategy, let me spend just a moment or two. It is a strategy. It is a plan. It was developed by the Fish and Wildlife Department over a number of years, had a great deal of stakeholder involvement across all spectrums of interested parties. It is based on the best available science. It sets out a series of goals and priorities that are met as guidelines to preserving and conserving the most important fish and wildlife habitats in the state. It is geographically specific. You can actually go on the department's website and look at a map and see where these high priority areas are. It has also been recognized nationally as one of the best plans or strategy in the country. These plans were required by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as part of one of their programs. So Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department is one of 50 states who has these things. We're specifically pleased to see that in Senate Bill 763, the bill uses the conservation strategy as a way of guiding where sending and receiving areas can be designated. From the respect of a receiving area, the bill says that if an area is identified as a conservation opportunity area by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, then it is not eligible to receive credits for additional development, because this would be counter to the intent of the state plan for increased conservation. And it also says, in terms of sending areas, that an area that is identified in the conservation strategy is eligible as a sending area to send credits. Then I know, as you talked a little bit last Tuesday, there is one small technical problem that we and others have raised with the bill, and I think there are ways to deal with it, but I want to clearly point out that the reference to the conservation strategy in Senate Bill 763A is incorrect. The language in the bill in several different places says that it was prepared by the department during September 2006. In fact, the department spent a good many years working on this thing. It was submitted to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission for approval. They approved it in 2005. It was submitted to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for approval. They approved it in 2005. And it was published in February of 2006. So we just would like clarification that it is the intent of the legislature that that is the document and the process that is being discussed here. We have had some concerns about an incorrect reference affecting the applicability of the bill in being able to use the strategy. I'm aware that there's probably not a great deal of interest in amending the bill at this time, although I would suggest all you'd have to do is strike out the date. But if our request would be is that you make it very clear, both in terms of the carriers on the floor and in your legislative record, that what you intend to mean is the Oregon Conservation Strategy as developed and adopted by the Fish and Wildlife Commission. And I ask Ron England to join us if you have any questions about the strategy. I know you also discussed a number of things at your hearing on Tuesday about conservation easements and tax implications, and I guess what, if you will allow me just a couple more seconds, I'd like to say a couple of things about conservation easements since we use them at the Nature Conservancy. The conservation easement is just another tool. It is a contractual tool between two parties. The terms of that tool are negotiated between the two parties. If there are two private parties, one that's buying and one that's selling, you can negotiate terms that meet both parties' interests. The important thing, of course, is that both parties, the buyer and the seller, must perceive value. And the value sometimes is associated with the length of time the easement would stay on the property. But it's a negotiable item if it's between two private parties. If it's between a private party and if there is any government or public money, then some different laws come into play. There are a number of conservation easements that use federal funding through the Farm Bill, and those programs identify specific terms for a conservation easement. There's also some programs in the state where public money is used for conservation easements, and those, I think, by state policy, for the most part, are in perpetuity. Because that is considered a good, thank you, a good investment of the public's fund is to have that security. There is a definition of a conservation easement in state law, and a number of things are keyed to that definition, one of which are some of the tax questions. And I would like to remind you that the legislature last session made a very important clarification on the impact on real estate taxes with respect to easements. There was lack of clarity around the situation of whether a landowner who had their property in a farm or forest deferral and chose to put an easement on it to move it into conservation, and realize sometimes you can't also operate farming practices and have a conservation easement. But if a farm or forest landowner chose to use an easement tool, that they wouldn't lose their farm and forest tax deferrals and be subject then to back payments. So what the legislature did last session was to clarify that in such cases, the tax level on the real estate for that private property owner would not change. So it would have a neutral impact on a landowner and a neutral impact on a county. The other sort of tax conversation you had with respect to income taxes, that is only relevant when a landowner is donating some part of the value of their easement to a charity, and in which case, of course, the IRS rules with respect to charitable contributions come into play, and they have something to say about how those conservation easements are structured. So I just want to take those few moments and chat about that, since that's a tool that we use a lot, and but then come back to asking you to make it very clear on the legislative record that the Oregon Conservation Strategy, as referenced in this bill, does mean the strategy as developed and adopted by the Fish and Wildlife Commission. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're not going to move this bill today. The chair has requested that we carry it over till Tuesday so she can be present for the vote, but we will make it clear on the record.
Thank you.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I got you there. So that bill from last session that you were just discussing,
mm-hmm.
I remember well, voting against it. I know you probably didn't like that. But my concern was, and I wondered how you'd feel if we ever revisit that, I just was interested in some sideboards to make it clear that the purpose of the conservation easement, if you weren't going to be doing agriculture, and so therefore you actually, you got to essentially keep your farm deferral even though you were no longer farming.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see some sideboards that it was for riparian protection or something specific rather than just general, because, you know, farm and forest deferral is for a reason, and those values, I think, on why you would give up farm and forest deferral well, no, retain farm and forest deferral, even though you're doing some conservation work, could be outlined, and we could figure it out and put those parameters in rather than, you know, sort of the other way around. We just give it to everybody and hope it's not going to be abused by somebody.
Chair Garrett, Representative Klim, if you'd like to revisit how to make it clear, we'd be glad to work with you.
I'm glad you're here.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. I think just real quickly, the thing I would point out the most about the conservation strategy is, as it was developed and designed, the whole intent was it was to be used for voluntary actions by landowners in order to have positive impacts on species and habitats of greatest concern and need, and not as a regulatory hammer. And this still embraces the ability to use it as a voluntary mechanism and a way to focus effort to have a positive impact on the landscape. So with that, Mr. Chair, I just make myself available for questions.
Okay. Questions for the panel? We're quiet today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 763. We'll carry over the work session until Tuesday, May 26. Last order of business is a work session, which will open on Senate Bill 566A. Ms. Ross, do you want to remind us what this is and what we did with it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure specifies that a metropolitan service district does not have to consider the capability classification system of the cubic foot site class of land it designates as urban reserve within an urban growth boundary. It would take effect December 1st, 2009, and there's been no amendment.
Okay, I think this bill is ready to move.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
I move Senate Bill 566A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 566A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Hammond?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Excused. Representative Winger.
I thought maybe you were looking around for a carrier.
Would you like to carry it?
I would be happy.
That'd be great. Representative Winger will carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, I think just for giggles, we should have all voted no and seen Mr. Tucker look on his face.
Yeah.
Okay, so we will close work session on Senate Bill 566A, and that is all the business before the committee. Adjourn.